Blog Talk Radio.
American Nationalist Network.
And good afternoon from the left coast of California, broadcasting from behind the Iron Curtain in the People's Republic of California. Welcome to this August 30th, 2013 edition of Worldview Conversations. Today we have a very special guest, one of my favorite people. Deanna Spingola joins us, and normally this is kind of a different situation. Normally she's the host and I'm being interviewed, but she graciously accepted my request to be my guest, and she's already done her show. She does a show every day. I only do two shows a week, but she's already done her show today, and she graciously accepted my invitation to be a guest on my show today to talk about her excellent research and her excellent books regarding the ruling elite and the Zionist seizure of power. Before we bring Deanna on, let me broadcasting note and a programming note. Next week on this show, on next Friday's Worldview Conversations, my guest will be Mark Weber of the Institute of Historic Review. We will be commemorating the anniversary of the German action in Poland and what many people refer to as the beginning of World War II. We're going to talk about real history that day. Then the following day, Saturday, as many listeners from my broadcast announcements, I have a special broadcast scheduled with Dr. Michael Hill of the League of the South. That show will be guest hosted by Mr. Robert Lloyd. He'll be standing in for me because I will then be actually down in Los Angeles at the Institute of Historic Review co-presenting a film with Mark Weber that evening and having meetings that afternoon. So I hope you enjoy next Friday's show, and then please listen to the special broadcast co-hosted by Robert Lloyd with Dr. Michael Hill. Without any further delay, because this is going to be an excellent show, Deanna, thank you for joining me today on Worldview Conversations. Like I said, you're one of my favorite people. You've given me a lot of opportunities to come on your show on RBN and to correct the record and to discuss real history, and I'm just really honored that you've agreed to come on my show today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your invitation. It is kind of a switch.
Yeah, it gives you kind of a break, huh?
Yes, it does.
Well, I've been appearing on your show. I mean, you know, off and on. I mean, it's been over a year now, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And we get a lot of listener feedback. I think I just emailed you just yesterday or the day before. The listeners are just just absolutely dedicated to you, and rightfully so. You've given a lot of what I call real historians an opportunity that the so-called mainstream media just will not give a real historian, because, you know, we're just shut out. And if it weren't for you, Deanna, we just wouldn't have any other venue to the larger audience. And let's face it, RBN does have a very large audience. And on behalf of real history and real historians, I just want to thank you, you know, for everything that you do in allowing real freedom of expression And I'm sure you get a lot of blowback and a lot of opposition, you know, to not have some of us unsavory characters on the show.
Well, I once in a while I do, yes, but I am a historian, an amateur historian, and I've always loved history. It was my favorite class in school. And it just is imperative that we understand what's happened before in order for us to understand what is going on currently. And if we don't have that background, if we don't have some sort of pattern so that we can see that everything that is going on now has happened previously, that they use the same tactics over and over and over again, and because they keep the government school system keeps the people ignorant, they just simply don't see these patterns.
Well, you know, you're absolutely you're correct, and you know a lot of, and I hear this from a lot of students now. Right now, I have several of my books out of my private library out on loan to some community college students, and they happen to have looked me up because a teacher said, you know, if you really want to get into some, you know, talk to someone that really gets into this stuff, go talk to the, you know, go talk to that guy, meaning me, and these students came to my door one day and they said, you know, pardon me, we're, you know, community college students and we'd like to, you know, we're doing a research paper and Professor so-and-so said that you might be able to help us. And that made me feel really good. They said, because you actually pose an alternate view of things. And so, you know, I invited them in the living room, talked to them a little bit. And I realized that they actually, you know, they weren't there under any other agenda, Deanna, other than they were actually seeking to listen to both sides. So I loaned them a few books. Now, one of them already returned one of the books. The other ones are still working on their paper, and I'm assuming they'll come back. But even if they keep the books, it won't bother me in the least because the information will be out there. But as you indicated, you know, if we keep allowing, as you refer to, the power elites to scramble our history or to throw it in a blender and just churn it up and then bring it out and, you know, and transform it into whatever they want, so it conforms to their agenda, we are going to be in trouble for time and memorial. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely. And they have actually said that they would write the history. Churchill said, well, if I want a really good view of what happened, then I will just write that to review myself. I will write my own history. And that's what he did. And of course, the victor always writes the history. So we never, ever have the opposite view. And just like what is occurring now, this is when they first started talking about the fact that they were using chemical weapons in Syria, that the Syrian government was using chemical weapons against its citizens. I thought, oh my goodness, so that's a reason to use military force. Well, if that's a reason to use military force, let's see. We've got some chemical weapons that the government is using, or the corporations that are in bed with the governments that are using against us. We've got aspartame, we've got fluoride, we've got all kinds of horrible, horrible chemicals that are creating a lot of deaths, a lot of illnesses here in this country. And yet nobody says a word about that. And I just thought it was kind of ironic. And when you consider this, that there are, according to some figures, are 900,000 deaths a year just because of the medical industry, and yet we don't hear anything about that. So, but this whole thing with the chemical weapons in Syria is that all of the intelligence came from the Israelis, which is, you know, questionable at best. And so we have this intelligence coming from the Israelis, and it's not been corroborated by any U.S. government agency. I mean, it's just so obvious. And I think that because of the seriousness of the situation, that is why you're having this worldwide opposition and protests all over the country and, as I said, worldwide tomorrow against a war in Syria. And we will not hear anything about that in the mainstream news.
Well, you know, you mentioned something, and I think we have to mention it on this show, Deanna, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, you know, called, you know, a vote in Parliament. Of course, you know, interestingly, his party, he's the Prime Minister, his party's in charge, and he lost the vote. His own party rebuked him. The British Parliament said, no, we're not going to go down that road and listen to the Americans, you know, and all their, you know, nonsense. And their, you know, and their artificial agenda, and so the British were put in check real fast. As a matter of fact, you had, I watched an interesting exchange. George Galloway had people who were giving him more time to speak who generally oppose him in the Parliament, and he made a very passionate plea. He was absolutely correct. And I don't agree with everything that George Galloway, you know, espouses, but he was absolutely correct in his opposition, and he was running out of time. And, of course, they were trying to cut off his, you know, he had 40 seconds to speak. And there was members of Parliament who normally just loathed Galloway, gave him some of their time to continue his plea. I'm going to be posting that clip, but doesn't this speak volumes? And this gets into your research in your two books. This global elite, these shadowy figures, the persons behind the curtain, using the Wizard of Oz analogy, Deanna. When did you first you know, feel the, you know, the responsibility? And I think all of us, you know, that are in, you know, the truth movement, or, you know, the nationalist movement, or the revisionist movement, you know, and some of us will do a little bit of work in all of those fields, but we feel a larger sense of responsibility, you know, to our people, to our children. For me, it's to my children, you know, and then, of course, to my people. But all of us have a different calling, you know, a sense of responsibility. When did you first feel the sense of responsibility that, no, I'm not just going to go along and get along? And there are people that will do that. They will tell us, and I'm sure you've run into them, Deanna, yeah, I agree with you, but that's just the way things are. And as long as I can have my big screen TV and, you know, have, you know, go to the shopping malls, you know, I'm okay. I don't care that, you know, we're being herded like cattle.
Well, I was actually... I was a geek when I was growing up. I always had a book in my hand. I read all the time. I spent a lot of time, solitary time, because I was always very comfortable with myself, and it didn't bother me that, you know, that I didn't have to have company all the time. But I used to do a lot of reading, and that has, you know, that characteristic has stayed with me, of course. But I first became aware of the Holocaust, or what I thought was the Holocaust, when I was 14, because I was reading books about it. And I picked up a book. It was by a Dr. Nisley. And I read this book, and as a 14-year-old kid, I believed it, and I thought, gosh, this is amazing. But then I started thinking, well, how come if these people are so smart? I mean, there's so many Jews that have won the Nobel Peace Prize, the Nobel Prize for this and that. If they're so smart, how could they be so stupid as to allow themselves, 6 million of them, to be slaughtered with just absolutely submissively just allow themselves to be slaughtered? It just did not make sense. And then after I got married and started raising a family, I read the book None Dare Call It Conspiracy by Gary Allen, and it was a relatively short book, and it talked a lot about some of the things that had occurred, that were occurring. And at that point in time, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't any groups that you could join except for the John Birch Society. And so I looked up the local John Birch Society, and I joined it. And their biggest issue seemed to be the get us out of the UN. Mm-hmm. And I worked my butt off, mm-hmm. you know, sending out letters, going to meetings, just a lot of busy work. I was the secretary of the local group, so I was sending out a lot of letters, doing a lot of things. And it just didn't seem very effective. And
I went to a lot of meetings with my grandmother, the John Birch Society. I can tell you that. They had a lot of meetings. I remember a lot of meetings growing up.
Yes. Excuse me. So, anyway, I just thought this is just, it's just spinning around. It just isn't going anywhere. And I felt that, and then, I would talk to my friends about it, and they would just kind of blow it off. I mean, it just was like I was the only one that was really interested. I only had one other friend that seemed to be the least bit interested in the seriousness of what was going on. And then I remember the 1973 with Roe versus Wade. And I was outraged. I was just outraged that the Supreme Court would do this.
Uh-huh.
And because I had a very, very difficult time having children. And I thought children are precious. They're a gift from God. And I just could not believe that the Supreme Court would pass this. And if you really think about it, a person, an individual. Now, for instance, if I had a neighbor who was pregnant and she asked me to come over and perform an abortion, I would be arrested.
Uh-huh.
So anything that a single individual is not allowed to do or is immoral for that person to do, then it is also immoral for a group, an entity that the individuals have appointed, supposedly have appointed, it is illegal, immoral, for them to pass a law that is not legal for a person to do.
Well, Deanna, I talk about outrage on abortion. I agree with you. I am absolutely with you on this abortion. I mean, I remember my grandmother and grandfather telling me that when that decision essentially was in addition to some of the other acts that came out of 1964, 1965. We talked about that on your show. Some of the primary weapons legislatively,
sure,
of the Jews, but that one, 1973, was horrific. But here, right now, in the state of Jerry Brown's California, there is a law that is going through the legislative process now, which Governor Brown has pledged to sign, that will allow non-physicians to perform abortions in the state of California.
Oh, I read that.
Yes, ma'am.
I read
that. That just goes to show you how fast we are devolving into into this genocidal, Marxist genocidal. And of course, there's no better, authers and perpetrators of genocide than Marxists.
Oh, absolutely. And then the abortion thing followed on the whole women's movement,
mm-hmm,
which was also just a Marxist movement is what it was, and it was certainly implemented by the Jews. We had Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Bella, what's your last name?
Abzug. Yes.
They were all Jews, and of course they were backed by the CIA, which is an agency that really implements the Jewish agenda all over the world.
Absolutely.
It just seemed like that was the greatest assault against the American family. And if you disable or dissolve or assault the American family, which is the primary unit of this country, or at least it was, then the country's going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Deanna, that was their primary, one of their primary, obviously their first objective, and I wanted to get your take on this because you've written two excellent books, and then we'll get into the titles of your books. But would you agree that their first objective, of course, one of my theories is they all flocked over here from Weimar and began to put their chicanery into practice, but their first objective was to take control of institutions, namely education, for instance, mainly primarily education, the media, obviously. But then they went right to work on destroying the family unit. If you destroy the family unit, i.e. the culture, which the family unit is the cornerstone of any culture, the culture of a society, then obviously they're able to do what's happened. You look at the United States today. The United States is just, I don't know how you would describe it. It's not a nation. It has no culture. It is basically this cooperative It's chaos. It's cultural chaos. It's financial chaos. It's everybody against everybody, and you have the Jews in the center pulling the strings with them triumphant. Would you agree that their primary objective was to destroy the family unit after they took control of these institutions, and they used the institutions to destroy the traditional family unit?
Oh, absolutely. And as you say, they did it via the educational system, which was implemented, well, even before 1900, but after 1900. Let's go back even further.
Yes, please.
They did, the Rockefeller Foundation, it wasn't a foundation until about 1910 or 11, or maybe 1909. But they were also in charge of something called Hamptonizing the South, where they would go in, and you can compare this. Oh, let me get a drink. I must have been talking too much today. You can compare this to the Hamptonizing of the South. It is what they did after the Civil War was over, and then you had the Reconstruction period. They went in and re-educated the people so that they would be able to tell them what to believe. And of course, we saw the same thing after World War II with Germany, with the denazification of Germany. And so you can compare the same, you know, the two situations, two countries, and the same tactics of re-educating the public. But Rockefeller, who was Jewish, according to a book called The Grandees, The Story of America's Sephardic Eliteness by Stephen Birmingham.
Excellent book.
It is. And he states that the Rockefellers were indeed Jewish. And so you have the Rockefeller Foundation taking over the education system of America. And, of course, this was getting rid of the homeschooling and the little country schools. And the foundation basically started in the 1870s, 1880s, the foundation for the monopolization of the educational system. So that now, it's a government education. The government is telling you what to believe, what to think, and this was certainly their intention. And of course, the intention was to dumb us down.
How did they, Deanna, how did they get the public? I mean, I've always been, I spoke at a Patriot group a couple of times, and I speak to them maybe once a month, and I'm kind of on their regular guest speaker list. How did they get the, my premise is when the American public, when I say American public, I'm talking about the Americans that founded this country, not the, third world illegal immigrants that came later as a result of the 1965 Immigration Act. But how did they get the American public to buy into government health care, government education? I mean, how did they do that? Because, for years, some of our greatest minds in American history, Deanna, did not come from public schools. They came from one-room schoolhouses where those schools, on come Sunday, that was the church on Sunday, and Monday through Friday, that was the community school where you taught all grades in, and you had the same teacher, much like the Finnish education model.
So how did they change the public?
Yeah, how did they get to buy? I mean, certainly the public, there had to have been some people saying, wait a minute, they're basically taking our education. How did they get the public to buy into it?
Well, first of all, it's incremental. And second, they always, whenever they want to do something to you, they tell you that they're doing something for you.
That's right.
That is always the case. But what they actually are doing, it's just like Obamacare. They're offering it as something that is beneficial, something that will help all of these poor, poor people who don't have any access to health care. Baloney. What makes anyone think that access to health care is going to make you healthier? It's really a benefit for the insurance companies that are going to be associated with this. It's always to help the corporations. And, of course, we know that the United States is now a corporation, and we know that each and every, most of the communities in this country are corporations. The police academies and the police forces in most of the metropolitan areas are a corporation. And so, and this occurred right after the Civil War, with the 14th Amendment. So it changed the structure of the entire country. And it has taken from the Civil War, from the end of the so-called Civil War, up to this point, to incrementally and gradually, to get everybody all obedience trained. And of course, it starts with I've written about the Pledge of Obedience.
Absolutely. Let's take a quick break right there, Dan. We'll be back in 15 seconds, and let's talk about one of your books. You've written two excellent books on the Power of Late. We'll be back in 15 seconds, and we're talking to Deanna Spingola today. Her show is on the Republic Broadcast Network. It's called Spingola Speaks, but she's my guest today. We'll be back in 15 seconds.
Hi, this is Susie Q. Tune in Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern for my show, The Patriot Dame, on the American Nationalist Network.
Okay, we're back with Deanna Spingola. And Deanna, you've written about this. You've actually researched this. You actually, at some point after your membership in the John Birch Society, you decided to go solo, as many of us have, and get into hard researching and exposing the real facts and real history. Tell us about you've written the books, The Zionist Takeover, and you've also written the book, The Power Elite. Which one did you do first?
Okay, The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation was the first book. And I got into writing this book as a result of being queried by two publishers in December of 2008. I had been writing for various websites since 2005, about February of 2005. I subscribed to News with Views, and I liked a lot of their articles, and so I submitted an article, and they asked me if I wanted to be a regular, and I said, sure. And so I was doing a lot of writing, and of course, with articles, you're restricted to about 2,000 words per article, which is hardly a drop in the bucket when you really want to examine an issue fully. And but I was doing these multi-part articles, and then I was approached by a publisher, a well-known publisher in the so-called truth movement, in the alternative movement, and he asked me if I would like to write a book for his company. Well, I was just thrilled. And 2 days later, another publisher, another alternative publisher, approached me and asked me the same thing. And I thought, gosh, this is kind of amazing. Because usually I think people have to run out and find a publisher, try to find somebody to publish their stuff. And here I had two publishers that approached me within 2 days of each other. And so I thought it only fair that I go with the first publisher. I signed a contract. And in January of 2009, I started working on my book, and we figured that it would come out in a year, in the fall of, we figured it'd come out about 2010. And so I worked and worked and worked and, researched and then... I guess I went overboard. I went from doing 2,000 word articles to doing, 700 page books. Except that by the time I got done with this, it was 1,200 pages. And so I worked with the publisher, and he said, "Hey, I know. Why don't we just divide it into three books?" And I thought, "Well, that's great. Okay." So, gosh, we were way into 2010, and things just weren't going along as I thought they would. The editor was just really sloppy. I didn't even pick out grammatical errors or just, I mean, it was like the book hadn't been edited at all.
That's a key. You have to have a really good, strong editor. That is key. Now, you started this in 2005. Is that correct, 2006? So this was what?
I started writing articles in 2005, right. And then at the end of 2008, I started on the books.
Okay, so you, all told, you worked on the books for, what, two, almost 3 years?
Yes.
Yeah, excellent. So when we see, when you say you're researching and writing, you're researching and writing.
Yeah, I'm not just kidding. I'm really working.
Yes, you're turning. Yes. I mean, and the works are there, and they're available on Amazon. So the first one came out finally. So it was, you took a 1,200 piece. Yeah, continue.
At the end of 2010, in September of 2010, when the book was supposed to come out, 2 weeks before the book was supposed to come out, the publisher called and he said, you know, I think you ought to remove all the Jew words. He said, you know, people will figure out what nationality they are just by their names. And I said, gee, I don't want to do that. And then he also wanted to have me work with this other lady that had never written a book in her life, but was just somebody on the internet. But she had a totally different viewpoint, totally different perspective, it just was not in the same direction that I was going at all. And he got us on a three-way call, and I said, well, do you even really want to work with me on any project? Do you know anything about what I am writing about? And I was really upset. That was on a Saturday. And on Monday, I contacted the publisher, and I said, look, you have not fulfilled any of the things that you mentioned in the contract that I wrote with you, that I signed. You did not pay me the upfront money that it was just a little $500 just to get us going. You know, just, he never paid that, and that was that should have been paid within 6 months of my signing the contract. And so I said, well, I'm just going to do this myself. And so I had these 1,200 pages, and I thought, well, I'm going to go ahead and divide it up into three books. And so I just started working on the first book, and of course I added things, and the more I worked on it, the more I found, the more I looked into the research, the more I looked for things, the deeper I went down the rabbit hole, the proverbial rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. And by the time that I got this book done, it was 700 pages, so it had expanded, and I found somebody that would print it and do all the marketing and all that kind of thing for me. And so it came out in 2011. I think it was June of 2011. And so I thought, well, and it sold relatively well. And I was happy with it. And so then I started working on the second in the trilogy. And it came out in June of 2012, a year later. And now I am in the process of finishing up the third in the trilogy, and I'm happier with each book as I'm working on it. I think I'm learning in the process of being writing a little bit better and maybe doing a little bit deeper research. And I think that anybody that writes a book learns more, and you can apply this to a teacher. A teacher who teaches a class learns more in the preparation of learning, in the preparation to teach a class, than her students will gain. And I think that's true, that the person who's writing a book is going to learn so much more than the person who actually reads a book. It's just that you become, well, just in the process of doing and learning, and it becomes just part of who you are. So it's been an interesting experience, and it's been very hard, because the reason, it's very interesting how I got involved in radio. In 2010, in September, I figured, well, okay, by September, the book was going to come out, and and then it did, and it didn't. And by the time that that I thought, well, I figured it would come out, and then I was kind of done with it. And so I was looking around for something else to do when I contacted John Stettmiller at RBN, because I had been on several of the host programs, Rick Adams and some other people that I'd appeared on their programs. And I thought, well, they don't have any women on their network. They need to have a woman. And so I contacted John Stettmiller, and we talked about it for a month or so. And I got a radio program, and it was once a week on Saturday night from 9 to 11. And that is almost like saying 3 a.m. in the morning to me, because I get up at 5 o'clock, sometimes earlier, because I think best in the morning. I get up really early. And by 9 o'clock at night on Saturday night, I'm not thinking anymore. It was just the hardest thing. I would try and lay down on Saturday afternoon to take a nap to try and get, refresh my brain or so. It was such a struggle. And after 3 weeks, he said, well, would you like a daytime spot? And I said, sure. So I went to daytime. I had 1 hour Monday through Friday. And I thought, wow, this is really great. And then it expanded to 2 hours. I think this was probably in December, January of 2011. And so I've been with RBN ever since.
You know, I was looking at the RBN. You know, you're right. You're still the only woman host at RBN. Am I correct?
I think you're right.
You are the only female host at RBN. As I was looking at their website, because I did link to your show page and then your website on the announcement page for this show, and I was just going through and it had the host page, and I was going through there, and I said, you know, I think Deanna is the only woman
female.
Host, yeah, female host on that network, and I thought that's kind of interesting. But and I think you're by far the best, but I'm biased.
Oh, thank you.
As far as, you know, show being substantive, I mean, your show by far, and not because I'm on your show periodically, but in general, you have such a broad array of just great guests and topics. You know, it's just you can tune in, you know, every day, and you have something different, and it's just, you know, people learn. They come away from your shows, Deanna, and they learn something. And that leads me to your first book, The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation. That's your first book. Now, if someone, now obviously, I would, you know, someone that's just, I know that would be interested, you know, that has a, you know, their interest is piqued. And, you know, as I said, I use the analogy, the dubious man behind the curtain, you know, the elites that actually are, that put Barack Obama in office, that put George Bush in office. I would direct them to your book, because you've been researching these persons. You talked about the Rockefeller Foundation, and isn't it interesting that these elites come up with these well-meaning foundations to do good charitable work to help the downtrodden, and what they're doing is actually, as you said, they're not doing anything for people, they're doing everything to people. But this, your first book, The Ruling Elite, walk us through that book. That's the first book, and then we'll talk a little bit about the second book in the second hour. We have about 20 minutes left in the first hour here, Deanna. Then we're going to take about a 3.5 minute break. What would the person that is just kind of curious, that, you know, they realize things aren't what they should be, what are they going to learn? Will they give us a teaser? And then, of course, the books are available on Amazon. There are links on Deanna's page at spingola.com. There are links on my website at wvfoundations.org to Deanna's books. They're a great read. I think you even have a PDF file for $10 if they don't even want to buy the, you know, the full whole book at Amazon.
Right. Well, I thought that the Civil War, the so-called Civil War, was certainly the model. It was the very first war in modern times that was total war. In other words, total warfare means that they target civilians. Now, when you talk about the Civil War, people generally think, without really looking at any of the details, they think, oh, this was the South, this was the North against the South, and they were fighting and all of that. Well, for one thing, it is so misnamed. A civil war is when two factions of a country are fighting for the leadership. This is not what the Civil War was about. The Civil War was actually the North invaded the South. Now, only only two battles took place in the North, which tells you a lot about who was fighting who and who invaded who. Most of the war took place, 98% of the war, took place in the South. And what they did to the South is just absolutely unspeakable. And when you think of the number of people that perished, the figures vary, depends on which expert you listen to, but I think that probably 722,000 people perished as a result of the war, and at least 50,000 civilians in the South perished. And the war was started with a false flag. It was provoked. It was provoked by Lincoln. He decided to send a ship. Well, first of all, let's talk just a little bit about what was going on. The South was actually functioned as a colony of the North. The North, where you had all the Jewish bankers, actually loaned money to the farmers, the plantation owners in the South, and just any business in the South. The South did not have any production or manufacturing base. They were simply they were very agricultural. And whenever they needed something, the retail people in the South would have to go north. And they bought everything from the North, or they imported whatever they needed from England. And so the Northerners would send ships down along the coast, and they would pick. The South didn't even send their cotton. The North, who had all the ships, they're the ones that sent the cotton over to England and elsewhere. And you had also the Triangle Trade, which involved the slave trade. The slaves would be picked up in Africa, then the Caribbean. They would go and pick up sugar and bring the sugar back to the North, where they'd make rum, and they'd make the rum, and then it was a triangle trade. And this was basically controlled by the Jews. And there's certainly a lot of evidence in other books that talk about this in greater detail than mine. But I do, you know, cover it. And so you had the South. So anyway, they were getting really tired of being exploited. And of course, you had also some Northerners who went south who were provocateurs. And they worked principally in the field of education. You also had the beginning of the Freemasons was also in the South. So there was a lot of intrigue going on. But the basic premise is that when there were certain states that wanted to secede, then Lincoln decided that they were not going to secede, and that his big deal was that he wanted to save the Union. It was never about slavery. We often think, oh, the war was about freeing the slaves because, oh, those poor slaves, they were down there, they were working hard and being mistreated. And of course, that propaganda came from Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote the book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, the woman had never been to the South, and she was paid and promoted by a group of people who who wanted a freedom for the slaves, but they didn't really want them up north. They just wanted them free. The North had what they call black laws, which prevented any freed black from coming up and moving into their communities. So they didn't care about the blacks, but they cared about the control of all of this business that was coming out of the South, the agricultural business. I mean, cotton was a big deal, tobacco was a big deal, and they were making all this money. They were making the money on shipping the supplies. They were making money on loaning the farmers the money to grow the produce, and they were the middlemen.
Reminds you of Weimar, doesn't it, Deanna?
Yes, it does.
They, you know, you mentioned this earlier in the show, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know that you talked about that unless we understand history, we can't recognize these dangerous elites' playbook. They don't change their game plan or playbook. They run the same playbook throughout history, and how they conceal it is throwing our history in a blender and jumbling all up and confusing people.
Sure.
And yet see the same playbook that the Jews were using in the early years of the United States by exploiting and totally acting as this, you know, parasite and just dominating the financial the financial systems in the North, and then dominating the South financially as well. And then they did the same thing in Weimar. I mean, you have the people, the real citizens, living in horrific conditions. And then they are living very high on the hog. And they do this through time and memorial, except the only difference is in, you know, centuries prior to that, you had city, states, and countries that had expelled them. We've never had the intestinal fortitude to expel them.
Right.
So continue.
Well, anyway, the Marxist revolutions that were going on in 1848 in Europe were not successful. And so you had thousands upon I don't know the exact figure of all the Marxists that fought in the revolution or in the for the North, but all of these Marxists that failed in Europe came over here. Because this was a Marxist revolution here in this country. And so they were fighting for the North. You had very, very, very few of them that went South, because the ideology of the North was exactly the same as the Marxist in Europe. And so they came over and they fought in the North. Not only did they fight in the North after the so-called Civil War started, but they actually worked to get Lincoln elected. Now, he was the first Republican to get elected, and before he was a Republican, he was a Whig, and of course, the Whigs evolved from the Hamiltons, the Federalist Party, which was run by the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have all these Marxists who are fighting. And even the exchange of prisoners was so unfair, because the South just had a very limited number of people that could fight. But the North had all of these immigrants coming in, and it didn't matter if they were locked up in Andersonville starving, because the other thing that happened is the economic blockade. The North, the Union, imposed an economic blockade. They suspended all payments, just exactly the same thing that Britain did against Germany in World War I and World War II. You have this blockade so that they were really starving the South. And if the civilians were starving, well, then you can bet that anybody that's in a prison camp is also starving. And so the North really didn't care about their prisoners in Andersonville or elsewhere, because they had this fresh supply of immigrants coming in that would fight this war. But let's even go back to Fort Sumter.
May I ask one quick question, Deanna?
Sure.
Is it not true that Abraham Lincoln had some very interesting pen pals in Europe, one of which was Mark?
Yes, indeed. They thought he was wonderful because he was doing in America what they failed to do in Europe. He was successful. Now, when you think about some of the excuses, the justifications for the United States military, the United States government, to send people out of the country, for instance, when they invaded Iraq. They invaded Iraq twice, actually, in 1990, 91, and then, of course, in 2003, because one of the reasons is because they said Saddam Hussein is killing his own people. He is going against, he is murdering citizens of his own country. Well, what the heck do they think that Abraham Lincoln did? Mm-hmm. He attacked citizens of his own country.
Some of those engagements, 50,000 died in one day or 2 days' time. He just didn't indiscriminately, and you had General Sherman attacking civilians, burning down homes. I mean, mm-hmm. the march to Atlanta would be considered ethnic cleansing. Today, we'd have to send General Sherman to The Hague for trial before the International Criminal Court.
But you have to compare it when you're talking about scorched earth, which is what this was. It was scorched earth. They burned everything in their path. Now, about a week ago, I rewatched the movie Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, I mean, I've always loved that movie. Mm-hmm. Just always loved the movie, loved the book. And I don't watch a lot of fiction. I don't read a lot of fiction. But I did watch the movie. And it was really true to form as far as the general principles here. But they went through the South and literally burned everything in their path. They killed the farm animals, the pets, the dogs, the cats, the rabbits. They burned the barns with the harvest in it. They burned everything and left the people to starve. Mm-hmm. Now, that's the exact same thing that they did in Germany in World War II. They imposed a scorched earth policy on Germany. And went after, in a total war situation. Remember, total war is when you go after the citizens. Because before the total war mentality evolved during the so-called Civil War, armies fought in a special place on a field. You had two armies, one against opposing armies, fighting each other. They never targeted the citizens.
Absolutely.
Never.
Yes. You're making an excellent point, Deanna, and another great example is you compare and contrast the 1940 German invasion and capture of France versus the 1944 Allied D-Day and subsequent Allied conquest of France. It's night and day. The Allies just bombed everything, and there are French people today that will say that the Allies just were so destructive, it was so horrific. It's the same playbook. It's just
exactly.
You wage war on everything, you smash, you destroy. Now, there are some people, uneducated and completely uncivilized, that say that that's all just part of hell. The famous phrase of General Sherman, war is hell. Well, yes, that is true, but war is not supposed to be hell. You're not supposed to purposely make war and make hell on the civilian population.
Exactly. Exactly. That is collateral damage. That is terrible.
Would you agree? Would you count Hiroshima and Nagasaki as another example of that playbook, Deanna?
Of course.
I would too.
Well, for one thing, Japan had surrendered in January of 1945, and before that, they had made about four or five attempts through other diplomats to surrender, and unconditionally.
Yes.
They did not have to bomb those two cities. But not only did they bomb those two cities, they bombed Tokyo, they bombed all of these other cities.
Sure.
And the reason that they did not accept the surrender is because, gosh, they'd been working on these bombs and, well, they had to use them, right? And that's what they did. But it was unnecessary, totally unnecessary because they had surrendered. And it's also interesting that if you go through my books, you will see the hand of Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the generals during the so-called Civil War were high Masons.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. High-ranking Masons. And you find that also among the people in the First World War and the Second World War, that they were, and when you're talking about Douglas MacArthur and people like that, they were Masons. And some of the people that were leaders in countries were also, I know I'm getting all, I'm just going all over the place.
No, I think you're right on, because your book, if you look at the title of your book and the premise of your book, The Ruling Elite, you know, who are the ruling elite? A lot of people make mistakes, Deanna, and I think you'll agree with this, is they think the ruling elite is Barack Obama and John Boehner and Harry Reid. Those guys are just mere puppets. The ruling elite are the people who tell them what to do. The ruling elite are the Jewish bankers and the multinational businessmen and the Rothschilds that tell them, you know, you're going to make a lot of money, you're going to have a high public office, you're going to be on talk shows and TV, and you're going to write the legislation, but only that we tell you to write.
Sure.
And the ruling elite are those that control our money. And there's that famous quote, we don't care who runs the government as long as we control the money. So I think you're not right off, you're not off topic at all. I think you're absolutely, and I think it's you're correct and on topic. And that's what the ruling elite is. And I think it's really important during the show that we inform the listeners just what an elite is and what it is not. An elite and who the ruling elite is not Barack Obama. It was not George Bush. It's not the Republicans. It's not the Democrats. It's those power elite that's behind the curtain that funds $1 billion now for presidential campaigns, Deanna, I think.
Oh, it's absolutely ridiculous.
It's insane. I mean, it's absolutely insane. And all of the great people that people hold up as heroes, like Andrew Jackson and dare say Abraham Lincoln, and said they wouldn't even be a flash in the pan today. It's just incredible. We're at our top of the hour, Deanna. Why don't we go ahead and take our top of the hour break? We're going to play one of our station promos, and we'll have about a 3-minute music break. Then after the music, we'll have another promo. And then we're going to come back in our second half, Deanna, and we'll finish up just a few minutes on your first book. And then we'll get into The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of Power. And I think that one is going to be very, very enlightening as well. So we're going to take a break now. For about 3.5 minutes, we're going to play another promo for our shows here on the American Nationalist Network. Then we're going to have our regular top-of-the-hour music break. And then we'll be back after the top-of-the-hour with our very special guest, Deanna Spingola. Stay tuned. Enjoy our music break. We'll be back in about 3.5 minutes.
Ethno News Now, David Bailey, and some random hosts. 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Tuesdays. What is Truth? Jim and Joe Rizzoli. Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern. Rockin' the Music World with Robert Lloyd every Monday on the American Nationalist Network.
And welcome back to our second hour of this August 30th, 2013 edition of Worldview Conversations. Our special guest today, our very special guest, is Deanna Spingola. Deanna, let's go into the second book, which I think is an interesting title in and of itself, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. And I like your cover art on both your books, The Ruling Elite, The Study of Imperialism, Genocide, Emancipation. You have the chain around the globe, or the ruling elite have basically enchained the globe. And, of course, that they probably have wrapped several more links of chain around the globe since you've even written in just the last couple years since the book has been out. But in The Zionist Seizure of Power, you actually have a World War One tank. You have Lenin. You have Wilson. And, you know, Wilson is a character that people, you know, really – we need to really focus on, because he really started – you know, the League of Nations was the first attempt at this UN and this one-world government to actually get it into power. And what's interesting, and, you know, people don't understand, is it was none other than the National Socialist government in Germany that really kicked that thing to the curb.
Right.
So let's talk about your second book.
Let me just make a comparison and give you just a little bit more information about Lincoln that we can compare to World War II and to World War One.
Sure.
Okay. Lincoln in 1865 began to talk about the war was ending. It was obviously the North was going to win. And there was all this destruction. The South needed to be rebuilt. And Lincoln started talking about, the war is over and the South should go back and resume their life and everything. And he didn't want to have any kind of a reconstruction, any kind of a he just wanted to let everybody go, you know, let all the Southern prisoners go. Let's get everybody back to work and everything. And there was a group of people in Congress called the Radical Republicans. You could actually call them the Marxists. And the people with all the capital, the people that wanted to make a lot of money. And so they thought, well, we can't have Lincoln doing this. This isn't what we did this war for. We want to go down there. We want to buy up all this property, all this land for pennies on the dollar, because that's what war is. It's really taking over the resources and destroying the people that you've fought against economically, destroying the families, destroying their ability to make income. And so the Radical Republicans, and we're talking about Andrew Johnson and other Edwin Stanton, and then the person that was in charge of the intelligence for the North, Lafayette Baker. And they decided that in order to implement their program, the Reconstruction Program for the South, which would allow all these so-called carpetbaggers to go down and buy up all this property, and what they did is they would raise taxes on all the landowners so that they could not afford to pay the taxes. So then they would have to leave their land, relinquish their land to people who had more money, and think about World War II in Germany, and of course after World War II in Germany, the Reconstruction or the denazification. And so they had to put a hit on Lincoln. They had to have a lone gunman to come in and do that. But there were dozens upon dozens of radical Republicans in Congress that planned on making a lot of money off the desperation and the destitution of the South by going down there and rebuilding it. And you had the same thing after World War One, where you had corporations that went in and loaned the German government money. You had the Dawes Plan and a couple of other plans. That it wasn't the United States government that was loaning the money. It was through the government, guaranteed by the government, but it was corporations that were going to go in and rebuild Germany and get top dollar for doing it. Well, you had the same thing in the South, but they had to get rid of Lincoln, which they did, and then they memorialized him and made him a hero, because the other thing, the other reason they had to get rid of him is because they would, the people in the South and the, some Northerners would start asking questions and saying, what the heck did we fight this war for? And how come this is happening now? So anyway, you can compare getting rid of Lincoln to getting rid of General Patton, who said the same thing. He said, well, no, you know, let's let all the Germans go home so they can rebuild the country, get back their life and everything. So they had to get rid of people who present this kind of mentality. Well, okay, the war's over. Let's get back to life. Anyway, that's a comparison. And of course, you have the comparison we made before about scorched earth. Okay.
Yeah. Which, of course, like at the end of World War One, the German army came home, and you know there wasn't any Allied occupation of Germany after World War One. But World War Two, you know, you had the situation where they just looted the country. You know, the Patton was a good example. You know, he put the government back to work. People that were running the, you know, supplying food to his district in Bavaria, and they weren't going to have that. There was, you were absolutely correct, Deanna. There was a, they were going to rape, rob, and plunder. That country, the Western Allies were going to rape, rob, and plunder that country just differently than the Soviets did.
Exactly. The same as they did the South. And the South has never recovered, and the people who lost their land had to go to work for the factories.
You talked about the re-education, and I think that's a fascinating concept. And let's spend a couple minutes on that. You wage total war on a country or on a people, in this case the North. You know, the South basically got tired of domestic violence. The Civil War, I always use a domestic violence analogy. You had, the Union was basically a union, which means it was a partnership. It was, and basically you had a group within that union said, we're done. We're not going to be abused anymore by this other partner, and they left. And you had the situation where the brute, you know, the partner that was doing the abusing came in and said, you're not leaving. And they abused him and hammered them into submission and made them stay into this brutal relationship.
Because they were exploiting all of the agricultural products that the South was growing. They were making the money. And then the South said, you know, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We are leaving. We are going to benefit from the resources in our own area, just like Iraq. Okay. Saddam Hussein said, hey, we don't want to have the oil companies come in and exploit our resources. We are going to have our resources for our own country. Same with Libya, same as all the other countries Vietnam, the Philippines, same thing, same playbook.
Sure. So what you have is you have this thing called the United States being used as, it's basically the United States has become a vassal state for this international Zionist, and we're going to get into that in your second book, ruling elite. And it's basically the, you know, between sometimes London and, you know, and Los Angeles and New York, and of course the United States military is its battering ram, is its club. And if any of these other countries, you know, don't stay with the program, of course, Saddam Hussein's great sin was, as you said, he said, yeah, our oil wealth is going to be used for our own people. And, of course, they also proposed, as you well know, that the trading of the oil would not be used in U.S. currency anymore. They were wanting to move away from using the dollar as the trading. And that was, I always believe, was the real reason for the first Gulf War and ultimately Saddam's demise, was he was strongly pushing that the, OPEC remove the, you know, the dollar as the trading currency for OPEC oil. And, that would have been the demise. You know, if the dollar is no longer the reserve currency internationally, then you're going to have a lot of international Jews losing a lot of money within minutes.
Sure. And you also had the sanctions in Iraq.
Sure. We starved them out.
Mm-hmm.
But my thought I wanted to run by you is you've demonstrated in your research is you have this evil global elite that uses that has basically co-opted the resources, the leadership, the institutions, and of course the military might of the United States to carry out its agenda, and they wage war not only do they smash and destroy the military forces of their enemies, but also the civilian, they wage war on the civilian population. But then they do this other thing. They destroy the culture and they re-educate the whoever they're going after. And we've seen that, as you indicated, in the South. We've seen that in Germany. We've seen that in Iraq. Look what's left. We don't do, when we talk about, when I hear this nonsense on Fox News about American exceptionalism and we are a force for good, is Japan, if we look at Japan today versus, you know, are they Japanese or are they some sort of hybrid Americans in the Far East? If we look at the Germans today, I had an interesting quote that I posted recently from a German who used to live in the DDR, and this German says, actually, you know, the Germans in the West are basically bastardized Americans with a German accent. They're so decadent. And I can understand where they're coming from. And so I think you've made probably an outstanding point about this absolute brutal tactics of waging war on the civilian population in addition to smashing the military of their enemies, and then this re-education and the starving out, and that makes that population dependent on the U.S.
Exactly, right. And you can even include in that the indigenous population in this country.
Absolutely.
With the scorched earth policy after the Civil War, the so-called Civil War, then the U.S. military went after the lands of the indigenous population, particularly the land that had all the resources, the gold in the Black Hills and elsewhere. And then immediately after that, you had the annexation of Hawaii because of the sugar and because of the corporate interest in Hawaii. They sent the Marines over there and basically said, okay, you either allow us to annex the islands or we are going to declare war upon you. And so that took in Hawaii, and immediately thereafter you had the Spanish-American War that started in Cuba, which with a false flag event with the USS Maine.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which then took Americans over to the Philippines, and you might say, well, gosh, how did this happen with Cuba, and then all of a sudden they're in the Philippines? Where the U.S. Began to, and it wasn't that they hadn't started vaccines earlier. There was a vaccine law quite a bit earlier than this, but they used the Philippines as guinea pigs to see how vaccines worked, smallpox vaccine and other things. They also had concentration camps in the Philippines. They called them the pacification camps, mm-hmm. Where they gathered people up and concentrated them so that they could control them. And at least 3 million Filipinos perished in this war of liberation from the Spanish.
It's interesting we call that a war of liberation. And was it a war of liberation, or did they just switch, colonial powers? It was just a swap of colonial powers. The United States wanted what Spain had, and so they steamed the ship into, you know, Havana Harbor and then blow it up. And, of course, you know, and then they created the outrage. Isn't it interesting, Deanna, that, again, it's another example of using the same playbook, and yet the American populace falls for it. But in fairness, when you have, the might of the media stoking the flames of emotionalism, and let's face it, Americans are emotional. They get very emotional when you have somebody come out and says, look what they did. They just blew up our sailors, and now our sailors' bodies are floating in Havana Harbor because these evil Spanish, assisted by the Huns, because keep in mind there were German advisors to the Spanish garrisons there, so they were stoking up, not only were they stoking up anti-Spanish sentiment, they were stoking up anti-German sentiment.
Sure.
You know, and of course, you know, that lead, not only that, they got some great ideas from the USS Maine when they did this really clever job with the Lusitania, which the Germans were justified in sinking.
Sure. Yes, exactly. And you mentioned Spain. Spain was not in the Philippines killing people. They did not have the money, the finances, the resources to develop the resources in the Philippine Islands. And so the corporations that are in bed with the U.S. government, who wanted to go in and develop those resources needed the U.S. military to go in and pave the way. Mm-hmm. And then the corporations went in and just destroyed the Philippines, tore up a lot of their land, like they did in Vietnam. And they don't go in and take the resources and then repair everything back to what it was. They go in, they rip up the resources, now there was mining in the Philippines before that, just independent miners, sure. Family miners, but the corporations would go in and destroy the environment and ruin the water and destroy the fishing, the offshore fishing. So it was just totally different than what the local people, how the local people would respect and treat the land. And you even have that in this country today with fracking. The corporations go in, they destroy big sections of the land, and then they leave. It's pretty sure. Disgusting.
Well, we've seen some interesting, some interesting lawsuits where citizens, they've lost their children, husbands have lost their wives to devastating cancers as a result of, here in California, the famous case where, the power company, dropped contaminants into the groundwater, and you had devastating impacts on families, and it's an example. But a great example, I'm sure you reference him in your book. I haven't gotten all the way through, but it was General Smedley Butler at the end of his life.
Oh, he's fabulous.
He referred to himself as not a soldier, but as a mercenary on behalf of corporatism.
Yes, and he wrote the book, War is a Racket. My grandfather was his aide in China, and they actually collaborated on a book. And of course, I do believe that the U.S. Murdered him. They convinced him that he was tired. He needed to go into a facility and rest and get his strength back, and he never left.
Well, the U.S. does that. Let's talk about that. They murdered him, but there's also another famous he was
second. Forrestal.
There's a history of these dubious deaths. Forrestal, they said what? The official version was that he just had a nervous breakdown and jumped out a window, as I recall. But
sure.
We know otherwise. We know that there are close friends, and my understanding is members of the Forrestal family that believe to this day that he was murdered. And I believe he was murdered.
Oh, absolutely. Anybody that speaks out, they're going to do them in. So.
But, keeping on Smedley Butler, I was hoping you'd bring up your grandfather. There you have it, a decorated, Marine Corps general who wrote a scathing, you can call it a confession, you can call it whatever, that the U.S. military was nothing more than a corporate mercenary army that was subjugating other lands. It was, at some point, the United States was supposed to be a republic. Molded somewhere on the Greek, read a lot of inspiration from the Greeks,
Never has been. Never has been.
No, never has been. It's been every bit as imperial as sought to be an imperial power as the British, and it's incredible as we go through history. Now, on your book, the Zionist Seizure of Power. And we look at Wilson, and we can start from Wilson. Wilson made this effort with the League of Nations, and that didn't quite stick because of some world events, and of course the rise of National Socialism and fascism in both Spain and Italy. You had a rejection in that period of time in Europe of nationalism, just a rise of nationalism, and this concept of one world governance and Marxism was rejected for a period of a good 20 years in Europe from 1919 to, again, where the global elite, the Zionist elite, the Jews, had to really muster and get the so-called capitalism of the West and the communists of the East to crush the fascists and the National Socialists in Central and Eastern Europe. To make
right.
sure that we have one world government. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the Rothschilds developed what we call capitalism. Mm-hmm. They called it the European plan. They developed capitalism or the European plan. They also developed communism and supported both of those And Woodrow Wilson is definitely an interesting fellow. He was the son of one of the founders of the Southern Presbyterian Church. And Sigmund Freud and William C. Bullitt, who is part Jewish, mm-hmm. Wrote a book together about Thomas Woodrow Wilson, A Psychological Study, is the name of the book. And he was kind of a mama's boy, a sensitive bundle of nerves is what they called him. And they exploited him. And he decided, well, first of all, he went to Princeton, and they promoted him and put him into a position of power as the president of Princeton. And they did this in action to give him some credibility, to give him some credibility, so that they could promote him later as president. You know, they work with these people in order to build them up, in order to put them in power, mm-hmm. Just the same as they did with Obama and everybody else that they put in power. But anyway, he attended Johns Hopkins University and as a political science major, and he wrote his doctoral dissertation on congressional government. He thought that the Constitution was outdated. He was friends with Fabian socialist mm-hmm. James Ramsay MacDonald, who was later the England's prime minister. And but anyway,
he sounds like a lot like Barack Obama in that the Constitution's outdated. He's a Fabian
yes.
socialist, doesn't he, Deanna?
Yes, yes, indeed. But Wilson's classmate at Princeton was Cleveland H. Dodge, whose father, William E. Dodge, was a wealthy industrialist. And he was a guy also that helped to organize the YMCA in America. Anyway, they started backing him and promoting him, and he became governor of New Jersey. And, I mean, they just started building him up. He had the backing of J. Pierpont Morgan, Walter H. Page, Grover Cleveland, Cyrus McCormick, all these people who had companies, they were industrialists. In fact, when he was Dodge was a Princeton trustee and the director of four banks, and they subsidized Wilson when he was a president of Princeton. So, I mean, the money powers were behind him. So anyway, when he was Wilson was married, and he decided that he needed to go on a little trip, and he went on this trip, and he met this woman. Now, they didn't have this great big huge affair or anything, mm-hmm. but they did. He did write her numerous love letters, mm-hmm. and these fell into the hands of certain people who decided that they would use this in order to manipulate him, and of course, just like they do with other political figures, they have something on you. They have something that they can use to blackmail you.
This is before he was a widower, too.
Yes, he was married.
Yes.
His wife, Ellen Axon Wilson, stayed behind. This was in January of 1908 when he decided, and his doctor said, you know, maybe you should take a little vacation to relieve the stress, you know, the daily stress of your position. I mean, and so he went to Bermuda. And he arrived there on January 20th in 1908, and he met somebody, this vivacious, sophisticated, talented woman by the name of Mary Peck. And she was 45, and she rented a house in Bermuda every year at the same time. Now, remember, his doctor told him to go down there. And Wilson was, you know, he's an idealistic, reticent preacher's son. Saw her, and gosh, she just You know?
He was smitten, wasn't he?
He was really smitten.
And he had a history of being sickly through his life anyway, and so he's supposed to be down there relaxing, and he's down there, you know, getting his blood pressure worked up.
Exactly. And Peck thought he was stilted, puritanical, but she just kind of enjoyed this adoration. And when he returned home, he wrote her letters, and she shared all of his political enthusiasm and aspirations. He referred to her by February, within a month. He was down there for over a month. He referred to her as my precious one, my beloved Mary. And after the trip, Wilson regularly wrote to him. And in December of 1911, she filed for divorce from her industrialist husband, whose name was Thomas D. Peck, and she resumed her former name, which was Hulbert, H-U-L-B-E-R-T. And so, somebody got a hold of all these letters. And so they used this against him. Later on, he went on to become president, and he was also he kind of got involved with the Jews, with people like Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, who was a Zionist organizer in America, and he announced to a New Jersey audience, and he said, and I quote, "On Tuesday, Mr. Woodrow Wilson will be elected governor of your state. He will not complete his term of office as governor in November 1912. He will be elected president of the United States, and he will be inaugurated for the second time as president." And he said he had it on good authority from House, referring to Edward M. House, mm-hmm. Colonel House, that neither of whom had ever met Wilson, but they had studied his philosophies and his private life and were satisfied that he was their man. And they had announced this, like I say, a couple of years earlier. And
sounds like Obama, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Again, they find this obscure person that they can, you know, again
manipulate and blackmail.
Yeah.
So the Morgan bankers, the Morgan cronies, encouraged Wilson to enter politics. And of course, Wilson was just, oh gosh, this, what a wonderful thing that they want me to enter, and they think that I have the right stuff to be president. Wow, this is wonderful. And so then you have the people who are in certain positions of power in state government, and this would be Senator James Smith Jr., who was a Democratic leader, and he got Wilson's name on the ballot for governor in the Trenton Democratic State Convention in October 1910. He had the support of Rockefeller, Schiff, Baruch, and others, and he won the governorship of New Jersey. And Dodge donated $75,000 to Smith for getting Wilson nominated. See, there's all this exchange of money. Hey, if you'll do this, I'll give you $75,000. And I mean, it's all about money.
Yeah, buy me a candidate. Buy me a candidate.
Exactly. And so so that's what happened. Wilson, in the spring of 1912, Wilson spent the weekend at Beechwood, which was Frank A. Vanderlip's estate in Scarborough on the Hudson River, along with William Rockefeller and others. And they had Wilson's ear. They told him what they wanted. And of course, well, he became the president.
And he gave them what they wanted. He gave them the Federal Reserve. He gave them control.
Sure, absolutely.
He gave them control of the U.S. currency. He gave them the income tax. He gave them the Civil War was the big cataclysm, but then Wilson finished it off. I mean,
absolutely.
The so-called progressive, they used, Deanna, these very clever names: progressive legislation, the progressive income tax, the Federal Reserve to level, to make sure we don't have these panics in the economy. But what it was it surrendered, it transferred our currency to the Jews, to private ownership. I mean, it basically gave our currency over to these private individuals, this power elite.
That's true to an extent, but you also had the imposition of Congress. Now, the Federal Reserve, we always hear, when they voted on the Federal Reserve, it was in December, and nobody was there, and they pushed it through. No. You had the Aldrich Plan first, then you had Congress met, and the House passed it, the Senate passed it, because they are the recipients of so many benefits. Mm-hmm. They are to this day. Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve, they're never going to get rid of the Federal Reserve as long as it is benefiting the people in Congress.
That's right.
They know who to vote. They know who to, where to invest their money. They're in bed with the corporations. They are in bed with the medical mafia. They are in bed with all of these people. And when a congressperson is elected, they might go there as a high school basketball teacher or coach or whatever, and they come back millionaires. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it is. But in that election in 1912, they split the vote so that Wilson would win. They got Theodore Roosevelt to run on his new Bull Moose Party in order to put Wilson, a Democrat, into the White House, because you'd had pretty much Republican monopoly from the Civil War on. But they wanted to get the Democrat in there. They wanted to get more Marxist representation in there, more Jewish representation in there. And so Theodore Roosevelt split the vote, and of course Wilson won.
Let me pose a question to you.
Sure.
The 1912 election has always intrigued me. Do you believe that Theodore Roosevelt was part of the fix?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, he was, because another theory is that they created this schism, this fight between him and Taft, so there would be a split vote. I tend to agree with you.
Oh, absolutely.
That he was part of it, because his policies were identical. He agreed with all of Wilson's policies.
Right, exactly. And remember that the Roosevelts are Jewish.
That's right. They are. Absolutely.
Okay. Not only were the Rothschilds Jewish, the Rockefellers Jewish, but the Roosevelts are Jewish, which I tend to point out in my first book. I talk about how the Roosevelts came in. They were selling land and dealing a lot with the Jews. They were in Amsterdam. I pretty much point that out in my first book. But the third-party candidate assured Wilson's triumph in the Electoral College. He took 41.8% of the popular vote,
right,
but he won 435 electoral votes from 40 states, and that gave him the presidency. And two-thirds of his financial support came from only seven people, all affiliated with Wall Street. You had Dodge, you had McCormick, you had Morgenthau, and we're talking about the original Henry Morgenthau Sr., and then you have to consider all of the stuff that happened with Morgenthau Sr. going as an ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. I mean, it just plays in so well. Okay, so you have Dodge, McCormick, Morgenthau, Abram Elkes, Frederick C. Penfield, William F. McCombs, and Charles R. Crane promoted him as a man of peace.
Yeah.
A man of peace. And yet they knew that they were going to go into a war. And so he concealed his affiliation, like most politicians, with the banking cabal. And he would appoint Morgenthau and Elkes as ambassadors to the Ottoman Empire, and which was recently targeted by the Young Turks, the cryptic Jews, for takedown. And so he would appoint the right people that would facilitate a lot of terrible things in the Ottoman Empire, including the genocide of the
the Armenians.
The Armenians, absolutely.
Yes,
was the fault of the Young Turks, who were actually Jews.
Yeah, interestingly, there is a used to be on Al Gore's network, which is now Al Jazeera. There was a show called The Young Turks. I can't pronounce the gentleman's name who hosted it. But he will fight, he will argue with you till he's blue in the face that there was no such genocide of Armenians.
Oh, yes, there was.
Seneca or whatever his name is. But yeah, he will talk about the evils of National Socialism, but when you ask him about the Turkish genocide of the Armenians, he denies it. And so I recently sent him an email and referred to him as a Holocaust denier. But you're correct. Isn't it interesting, Deanna, that you have this same, and I'm really, the way you've actually constructed, talked about, you've named the names of this cabal, these group. You look at Morgenthau, okay, and of course his son became what in the next Roosevelt administration?
Exactly.
And he proposed what? The absolute destruction of the German nation and the German
absolutely
people. And Morgenthau was a Jew.
Exactly.
I mean,
and
continue.
Okay, so then during a 30-day period, we're going to talk a little bit about Colonel House.
Yes, please do, because he's an intriguing character.
Now, Colonel House had a working copy of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. And he was sent over to Europe to evaluate what's going on over there, who was wanting war, who didn't want war. But during a 30-day period, Colonel House wrote a novel in New Haven, the site of Yale University, the novel from which Wilson developed his program. And the name of the novel was called Philip Drew, Administrator, a title that might refer to the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which state, and I quote, "The administrator shall we choose." In other words, we are going to choose all the presidents of this country. His book was published anonymously in 1912, and it elaborated on plans for America's overthrow by establishing socialism as dreamed by Karl Marx. House wrote, and I quote, "It cannot be entirely brought about by comprehensive system of state ownership and by leveling of wealth, but not without a spiritual leveling," which is what we talked about, the destruction of the family. Mm-hmm. He quoted Giuseppe Mazzini, and he said, "No war of classes, no hostility to existing wealth, no wanton or unjust violation of the rights of property, but a constant disposition to ameliorate the condition of the classes least favored by fortune." In other words, let's get rid of all of these poor people. Let's get rid of the middle class. We're going to have the very poor, the destitute, and we're going to have the very wealthy. He dedicated his book to, and I quote, "to the unhappy many who have lived and died lacking opportunity because in the starting the worldwide social structure was wrongly begun."
Deanna, may I ask you to pause right there for a minute? Because
sure.
It's very revealing. You talk about their goal and objective was to have the very poor and the destitute and the an extremely wealthy upper class, and that very poor and destitute would be dependent upon that upper wealthy class and
for
the
everything.
Government, so they would be subservient, so therefore they would never rise up and bite the hands that feed them. Does that not reflect the United States today when you have 50% having to get their subsistence, food, shelter, energy assistance, all these other programs from the government, and they're terrified. They may be absolutely opposed to the direction, the moral direction of the country, but they don't dare say anything about it because they have now become dependent because of what this Jewish cabal has done, has basically destroyed the middle class. They are now in that category of being destitute and dependent upon that power elite's generosity.
Exactly.
And
dependent
it's not generosity.
On...
It's a new slavery, Deanna, and it's a new slavery.
It is, absolutely.
Yes.
Now, in August 1912, during the presidential campaign, Louis D. Brandeis and Wilson first met for a private 3-hour conference in New Jersey to discuss economic issues. Afterwards, Brandeis supported Wilson and urged his friends, Jews,
yes,
his Jewish friends, to do likewise. And Wilson began using Brandeis' term, regulated competition. The bankers installed House as Wilson's mentor when he entered the White House on March 4th, 1913. The Schiffs, Warburgs, Kahns, Rockefellers, and Morgans had complete confidence in House's abilities to properly manage Wilson. While the bankers sought the passage of the Federal Reserve Act, they pretended to oppose it to keep the public from suspecting that they were actually behind it. Now, in addition to House, others influenced Wilson. You had Felix Frankfurter, you had Walter Lippmann, you had Bernard Baruch, had Sidney Hillman.
A whole synagogue there going on.
Yes, indeed. Now, allegedly, Brandeis was instrumental in developing the Federal Reserve Act, and he decisively argued to break the deadlock on the issue. He convinced the Wilson administration to devise proposals for further legislation that would allow the Justice Department the authority to enforce antitrust laws. He helped create the Federal Trade Commission and was Wilson's key economic advisor from 1912 to 1916. 2 days after Wilson took office, William G. McAdoo, who was a Pilgrim Society member, a lawyer, and a businessman, became the Treasury Secretary. Now, J. Pierpont Morgan and his associates previously befriended and helped McAdoo resolve his difficult financial problem, for which he was very grateful. So you have the Treasury Secretary installed by the bankers.
And they gave him a slush fund.
Yes. Yeah. And then they appointed him They bailed him out, then they gave McAdoo, before he became the Treasury Secretary, they appointed him as the president of the Hudson and Manhattan Railroad Company, now known as the Port Authority Trans-Hudson. And the bankers introduced him to Wilson in 1910, and McAdoo later worked on his campaign and actually married Wilson's daughter, Eleanor R. Wilson, at the White House on May 7th, 1914. So here you know, this an arranged marriage. It just all fit together so beautifully.
We have political institutional incest. I mean, I'm just surprised that all these this political class doesn't have huge frontal lobes, Deanna. It's just incredible.
And you look at what I believe is an arranged marriage. You have Michelle Obama and Obama, who is.
Yeah, I have no doubt that it's
notoriously homosexual.
Absolutely. I'm glad I was going to bring that up before the show was over, Deanna, about, you know, you talked about the love letters that they have as the leverage on President Wilson. There is no doubt that the homosexuality of Barack Obama is the leverage they have on him.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Certainly. And what they did, Samuel Untermyer, a prominent New York City lawyer, member of the Tammany Society, and later the president of Karen Yashad donated generously to Wilson's campaign. And he approached President Wilson with an interesting collection of letters that Bernard Baruch had purchased for $65,000. Wilson's friend, Mary Hulbert now, because she got her name back, retained Untermyer to initiate a breach of promise action against Wilson. Her son, Mary's son, happened to be a bank employee, desperately needed $40,000 to avoid arrest. She would be willing to drop her suit for $40,000. So apparently the $65,000 that she received for the letters was insufficient. So it was just it was a shakedown.
So it was $40,000 for her son and $20,000, but $65,000, and can you imagine, that was a lot of money in that period of time, Deanna. I mean, that was a lot of money.
Okay, and all that Wilson had to do was appoint Louis Brandeis as a Supreme Court justice when the next vacancy occurred. Now, so
first
this
Jew
was,
on the Supreme Court.
Yes, yes, indeed. And this occurred on June 1st, 1916, and the New York Times article dated December 8th, 1922 reported that Untermyer had, and this is just getting back to Untermyer, he had big financial investments in the Mosul oil fields in Palestine. Mm. So you have all of this. There's a lot of resources in Palestine, and which I talk about in the second book. It was not just about the significant area, the strategic area, but it was also like the minerals in the Dead Sea that were worth trillions of dollars now. And so
you talk about that. You talk about that real briefly. You break up. You talk about the Mosul oil fields and all that. And what is we call Iraq today. The whole breakup of the Ottoman Empire was for the benefit of this thing we call British Petroleum, is it not?
It's over a lot of stuff.
Okay.
It's petroleum. And of course, the British had been in Iran as early as 1907 and exploiting labor, cheap labor. I mean, the whole area has been exploited dreadfully.
Well, there's been no good out of the Western influence or the Western presence in the Middle East, I mean, especially the British. Now, let me rephrase that. I am very much pro-German, as everybody knows, but the Arabs have always gotten along well with the Germans. There was never any, when the Germans had colonies in Africa, there was never any uprisings in fact, the Germans didn't even have military troops in their colonies. And so this business of saying that the indigenous populations in, say, Africa or in the Middle East didn't get along well with all Europeans is not accurate. We just know that the British policies and the American policies
were terrible relative
to Africa in the Middle East.
Right. The Germans always worked with people on a symbiotic relationship where both parties benefited equally. And when the Germans went down and wanted to build the railroad, the Baghdad to Berlin railroad, it was to help both parties,
right,
not to exploit the Ottoman Empire, the Iraqis. It was always on both parties would benefit, and it would be wonderful for both parties. They were never into exploiting and stealing resources.
Right, right. It's just incredible as looking at the body of work that you've looked into, and I'm very intrigued at the second book, "The Zionist Seizure of Power." And I keep looking at the cover art here as I have it online here. You got Wilson, and of course, Wilson in the United States, and then you have Churchill, doing the grave digger of Europe, as Joseph Goebbels called him. He was his exploits at not only was he embarrassed because of the Gallipoli action, but all during the 30s, he was doing the Jews work as well. And what did he end up doing? He was not only the grave digger of Europe, but he was the grave digger of the British Empire. And one can make the case that that was probably part of the Jews' grand scheme of things as well. Would you agree?
Yes. He was so instrumental in this country also. I have a chapter. Let's see. Yes, it's in this book. I have a chapter on the crash of 29. And Churchill was very much involved in that. He came over here before the crash. The whole thing was orchestrated, and he had a hand in it.
Yeah, he had no money, Deanna. This is what I wanted to ask you in your work researching these characters. He had no money. He was broke, and yet he always seemed to have Jewish benefactors paying him to go around being self-important.
Well, they bailed him out several times. In fact, the Jews also Natty Rothschild was a good friend of Churchill's father, Randolph, and he is the one that lent Churchill money to invest in Africa, but he never paid him back. So it didn't just start with Winston. It started with Winston's father, that they had this this indebtedness and this relationship with the Jews.
Okay. Now, Churchill himself wasn't Jewish. He was one of their useful idiots that they gave a sack of cash to do their bidding.
Yeah. Now, some people say, oh, his mother was part Jewish, but whether she was or wasn't is immaterial. I don't know. I have never seen any proof of this.
I haven't found that either. I've just found him to be just a
he's just a useful idiot.
A decadent, big decadent drunk that did their bidding because he was broke and sold out and decided to be on the wrong side of history and took the British Empire down with him.
And he liked the power.
Yes.
The power was, intoxicating.
Clearly a megalomaniac.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. He was just a pig. Just, I, What a disgusting human being.
Well, recently in the British press, you know, they have to run, you know, several articles every week. If it's not, you know, it depends on what publication is. They were running this article, you know, Adolf Hitler drug addict or something of that nature.
Oh, I know.
I posted a comment, and they posted, I don't know if it's still there, and I asked them, where is their articles about Churchill running around drunk and nude in front of his in front of all of his male staff, which he did do. He did that quite frequently. And there's some conjecture that, you know, he would even have, you know, walk around nude in the White House when he was hanging out, sometimes up to 30 to 40 days at a time living in the White House when he should have been, you know, in London during the, you know, during the war that he instigated. But there you have another example. Now, he was a non-Jew, and yet he was there, you know, taking their money and such. You have this symbiotic relationship between London and New York. You have the Jews dominating London and New York. Is that their two primary control centers, their headquarters?
Yes. In fact, in 1897, the Brits and the Americans signed a kind of an informal compact that they would work together as a team, that they would share in the plunder of the countries that they invaded, and that they would be buddies. And that's been true ever since. And if you look at the timeline, I have a timeline at spingola.com for book two, you will see that the first Zionist conference also occurred in 1897. I like timelines. I think timelines are very important.
I think for readers that are, particularly if we're going to wake people up, or readers that are curious, the more visual aids we have, graphs, charts, timelines to really tie things together, I think that's very, very, very helpful. At what point did the – because obviously the United States is their primary weapon. I mean, I just don't see other than this, you know, being a headquarters for their European office. At what point did the Jewish power elite step out of London and say, that's it, we're going to hedge, you know, the U.S. is going to be our primary vehicle?
Well, after World War II, of course, they took over. The United States took over as the primary military force in the world.
Were they ever going to – I don't mean to interrupt. Were they ever going to play – I mean, was the Soviet Union ever a major player? Was the Soviet Union transitional?
I think it was transitional. It was a period of time where the where they could weaponize Israel, where they could build up Israel. And also to build up the military-industrial complex, because look at all the money that was put into all of these programs, Star Wars and all the other things, even the moon landing. I mean, that was a big farce. And you have to ask yourself, well, which corporations got all the money? Because if you look at the equipment, the moon landing, you know, the vehicle and all the stuff, I mean, you know, I mean, that was just a big transfer of money from the U.S. taxpayers to the corporations. So it was a time where the U.S. government and the media could collaborate and scare us, say, oh, we've got to have this program, we've got to do this, we've got to have armaments because, oh, look at those Russians, look at the Soviets. Who knows when they might attack us? And so it was, you know, another boogeyman.
So it was a tool used to increase budgets, and then when the Soviet Union, they were done with it, it was a controlled demolition. They got rid of the Soviet Union, you know, in about 24 months between, say, 1988 to early 1991. That's
right.
Why it was considered the fall of the Soviet Union was a controlled demolition.
Exactly.
Sure. Well, tell us, Deanna, when's the – we have about four minutes left. Tell us, you're working on book three. What's your – when can we expect book three, and do you have a – can you tell us what the title's going to be, or is that still a state secret?
It's going – I had planned to get it out in June, and it just did not happen. It just didn't happen. You know, I just kept finding things, and I could keep writing in this book until for the next 10 years. But I am going to try and get it to the printer in about 2 weeks. That is my plan to get it there. And it's just, you know, my life is so full. Mm-hmm. It does take time to, to get guests for a radio program, to get prepared for a radio program, to read the stuff you need to read for your guests and things. And it just got, you know, I just got waylaid.
Well, I know it. In fact, you do a show every day. Every day, and so you're actually hustling to, you know, get guests on your show, and then you do Deanna, you do Spingola specials as well as your everyday show on RBN. Then you're reading and researching in addition to just your work on the book. Is that correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and then you actually have, you know, other you know, hobbies and interests in addition to this.
Yeah, I actually have a life.
That's right. Well, that's what I tell people as well. You know, I have wife and five children and a bunch.